Hello and welcome back to the Bunker Daily. I'm Naomi Smith. If you missed out on our live show last week, have no fear. If you sign up to back us on Patreon today, you can watch the recording and of course you'll get first dibs on tickets to the next show and all sorts of other goodies too. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more. Today we're going to be talking about COVID-19, but perhaps not in the way you might think. Because I want to shine a spotlight on what is currently a hidden crisis. The growing numbers of previously very fit and healthy people who contracted the illness, and sometimes incredibly mildly, but who have nevertheless never fully recovered. It's been dubbed long COVID on Facebook groups around the world, where sufferers gather to share information about symptoms, the impact of their mental health, and the lack of help from the medical community. Some contracted COVID more than 6 months ago, but are still unable to return to work or lead anything close to the life they did previously. Symptoms are wide-ranging, from headaches, brain fog, skin tingles and muscle pain, to stomach issues, fever and chest problems. Chronic fatigue seems to be the most universal complaint, and that's not just feeling tired, it's feeling almost unbearably fatigued, where even using the most modest amount of energy doing a basic household chore could leave you bedbound for days. It's believed that long COVID could be affecting up to 10% of those who catch the disease, meaning that more than 1 million people globally and 30,000 people in the UK are already suffering from these debilitating after effects. With me to teach us more is a long COVID sufferer, former runner and professor of infectious diseases at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, Paul Garner. Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
Do you know how you got COVID-19?
I work in a university where there are many doctors coming and going from the hospital, and I think it must have been perhaps from the workplace. A lot of the young student doctors that were on our course also became unwell with it. So I think that's how I got it, but it's not entirely clear to me.
And tell us your journey. You know, when did you get it, and how many sort of weeks and months on are you now?
So I'm just starting my 17th week. I became unwell on the 19th of March. This was at a time when the government was pursuing a policy of development of herd immunity, or certainly that's when I caught the disease at that time. And I felt a little bit strange. Nothing more than that. Mm. I hadn't got a temperature. I was checking my temperature in the morning every day I was going to work, but I just felt a little bit strange. And someone, David Nabarro, was on a conference call and said, anybody that feels a little bit unusual or anything changes, self-isolate. This disease is a very strange disease. So I did, and I didn't really believe that I was unwell.
Because you didn't have the symptoms that at the time the government was saying, you know, the persistent cough, the fever. If you've got those, self-isolate. But if you feel any other weirdness, carry on as usual, wasn't it? That was the advice.
Yes, exactly. I didn't have any of the classical symptoms. That's why I went into work. But I didn't feel completely normal. So I went and self-isolated, and people said, oh, well, you'll probably be all right. And then after 3 days, I became really quite unwell with still no fever, but really feeling very fatigued, very sweaty, very muggy headaches, sort of brain fog. I couldn't think straight. And on the fourth day, I sort of collapsed in bed with very severe fatigue, very severe headache, and a paralysis of the body. I actually felt my life was draining out of me. I actually thought I had my heart was racing, and I thought I had an infection of the heart, and this was it. But it was so strange. I fell asleep and then woke up and then entered this next 10 weeks of just recurrent bouts of illness that would come out from nowhere and sort of hit you around the head with it, like being hit by a cricket bat. And then in between times, I'd actually feel not too bad. I'd feel a bit muggy, but I feel not too bad. So it was extraordinary, and lots of really unusual symptoms. I you know, loss of smell was fairly early on. I was completely worn out, aching muscles, headaches, ringing in the ears, tingling in my fingers and my arms, pains in the small joints of my hands, sweaty layers of clothes. So people in the house used to say, well, you're not going to be very well today because I'd have four or five layers of clothes on, even though
that was the signifier. Yeah. So, you know, all the official advice is still, if you, you know, get any symptoms, to self-isolate for 7 days. If you have symptoms, or 14 days if you're living in a household. And, you know, most people get it mildly and recover very, very quickly in that kind of time frame. So why aren't we being told that this actually could affect you for far longer?
Because people didn't know. At the time, I kept waking up every morning expecting the disease to have evaporated. I thought, it will be gone today. And each day it was still there. That was day 21. And I was Googling online, and the advice said it'll be a couple of weeks, or maybe a bit longer if you've been in hospital. And at the time, nobody really understood that it might go on for a long time. My neighbor, who is a general practitioner, came and saw me on day 30 and said, and was really concerned that I had a lymphoma. He thought, we were missing something. People honestly didn't realize it was going to go on for so long.
But how common do you think long COVID is now? I mean, I sort of read out some stats at the top of the show, but what's your experience of how many people might be suffering this very, very long road to recovery?
I think that is probably an underestimate, but, you know, it's just an impression. I think there's a lot of people out there that are suffering from a whole spectrum of different residual effects from this infection. I think that there's a whole range of things that are happening because the disease attacks all the different organs of the body in different ways. It's leaving people with varying problems. Some people have problems with their heart, and their heart rate keeps going up unexpectedly. Other people have other things, but it really is extremely common. One of the things that I think needs to be explored further is that after about the 8th week, I started realizing that what my activities, what I did, actually influenced how I felt. So if I walked a little bit too far, or I did a little bit too much on the computer, I would be, a day or 2 days later, I would be thrown back with the old symptoms of the illness. And I think that this problem is as yet underestimated for people.
Yeah, because you've written about it feeling like an echo of the original illness every time you get run down or you know, overdo it, as you've sort of said, the relapse is kind of similar to what you felt when you originally got it back in mid-March. Is that common with other post sort of viral illnesses, that they kind of mimic the original one that you had? I mean, as I understand it, you've had dengue fever as well. This sounds worse.
So dengue fever, the post-viral condition I was in was different. It was like driving with a handbrake on. This is a completely different setup. Sometimes after you've had a good sleep, or if you've rested well, you actually feel really good. You feel on top of the world. And then you go out and perhaps walk a little bit further than you normally do, or you spend a little bit more time on the computer than you should do.
And give me some context for that, because you were a runner. So you saying walking perhaps a little bit further than you usually would, like, just help listeners understand what that means. Does that mean walking to the end of the street, or does it mean doing a sort of, you know, 10K long walk and then, you know, ending up near a pub or something?
Yeah, I was running 10, 15 kilometers in one go before I became unwell. Now I can walk up to 4 kilometers, and that really is my limit. I think if I go to 5 or 6 kilometers, just plain walking, I run into problems. I was doing an hour sessions of intense yoga 3 times a week before I started this. Now if I do 10 or 15 minutes of yoga on 2 consecutive days, it can set me back. It really is. I would cycle 30 kilometers, 3 days ago, I cycled to my sister's birthday. It was a 15-minute cycle ride there and back, and I was floored for the next 2 days. You have to be so careful. It's actually quite complicated to negotiate this viral fatigue. And you have to have some insight into it, because it isn't like an hour later, it's a day or a day and a half later.
Yeah.
You have to record all your patterns of activity to try and work out what's going on. And it does bring back the old symptoms. And it's very, the literature that I'm finding very useful is the chronic fatigue ME literature. Mm. Although I'm not in that stage, in terms of timelines and so on, it's much more useful than much of the medical literature about this. All the self-help groups about pacing is really, really helpful. And the people that have been most useful to me have been people that have ME, who are very kind, and they help me learn that I will make mistakes with this pacing. They help me be forgiving, and they help me understand that you have to just reduce your expectations of how you spend your day.
And we know that ME sufferers are routinely ignored, dismissed, not believed by medics and by non-medics, employers and people in their life who think, oh, you can't possibly be this tired. Could we be storing up a mental health crisis on top of a physical health crisis if long COVID sufferers aren't taken seriously? Or is this maybe an opportunity now if, 30,000 more Brits are about to join this kind of chronic fatigue community, that we might be able to get them the resourcing and help that they've, just simply not had for the last few decades?
I agree about being believed. I think part of the post-COVID condition is actually not a single condition, it's a spectrum. And part of it is very, very similar to ME and chronic fatigue. There's no doubt about that. However, other people are experiencing other long-term effects. But I do think from the Facebook pages, at times, patients are not being believed by employers and by health professionals when they go with long-term symptoms and often quite bizarre symptoms, sensations, I haven't had this, but sensations of things crawling under your skin, sensitivity to certain clothes that you put on. They sound rather odd, but they are real. And I think doctors are, general practitioners are catching up fast. I do think we shouldn't set this up as a confrontation, but I think it's almost an opportunity to take seriously some of the symptoms and the problems of people that have chronic fatigue and post-viral syndromes in the past, because at times my own profession has been dismissal of them, think that it's anxiety, yeah. think that it's a mental health problem. And it isn't, because as soon as you're told that, it makes it even worse for you.
Indeed. Because obviously I think there's the mental health impact that is a mental health impact that comes from, the depression and anxiety about not knowing how long it will take to recover, if you will ever recover. That must be incredibly worrying. But there's also, just to go back to the symptoms you talked about at the beginning, this brain fog, this brain mist, becoming more forgetful, finding it difficult to articulate yourself. And you believe that's much more of a physiological thing. You don't want that to be labelled and dismissed as a mental health condition.
I agree. I think that this disease messes with your head. So obviously we are experiencing these weird symptoms, but on top of that, the disease is getting into your head somehow. And I've described how I've woken up with very low moods, absolutely full of tears in my head and just feeling terrible. But then, you know, later on in the day or in the following day, I'm absolutely fine, which makes no sense in terms of a depressive illness. So I do think it does. I understand that we have anxiety there as well, but the brain fog is extraordinary. I mean, I've been putting shopping like cans of baked beans into the refrigerator when I come back from Tesco's, and I was on a conference call the other day and found it was very difficult to speak, and that was part of the tiredness, not realizing that if I spent a lot of time on Zoom calls, that mental stress would make me worse and bring on difficulties with speech.
So, I mean, you said let's not set this up to be a sort of combative thing between, you know, patients and the medical community. But talk us through how the medical community are responding to the issue of long COVID. I mean, obviously, very understandably, their attention and time and energy and money and all the rest of it had to be focused on the acute peak. But do you feel that now we're sort of through that a little bit, and, you know, hopefully we won't be crashing into a second wave too soon, that you're still being left in limbo, or that there are sufficient numbers of medics beginning to be concerned about this and take it seriously?
So I think it's complicated. I think the initial concern with rehabilitation is being people in hospital that have been ventilated, because the consequences of the ventilation are well recognized. I think that the community we're talking about has a louder voice now, and people are moving quite quickly. I think the long haulers like myself have gone through learning phases ourselves. Like, initially everybody was saying, why aren't doctors doing something for us? Why aren't they investigating us? And then the community is finding that actually when they do the test, there's actually not a lot wrong with, you know, there's not a lot found. And so the community is beginning to realize that actually convalescence is going to be very important once you've selected out those people that really do have medical scarring on their lungs and so on.
But that's not to say that long COVID isn't medical, though. Surely this is just sort of highlighting, and maybe for some in the medical community, this is a difficult thing to accept, that perhaps this is just something that medicine can't yet understand.
Well, I think medicine and we need to help people with pacing. So it is very complicated. I'm finding it difficult not to overshoot in my work activities and in my physical activities. And it's getting an understanding of how this overshooting of going above your baseline, how many people this affects in this COVID community, because it may not be everyone. It might be just a subgroup like this, but people need help with this, and they need an understanding. Now, we've got a medical set up in the UK where the latest guidelines on chronic fatigue were produced by NICE 13 years ago. And those guidelines emphasize the need to increase exercise once you've established a baseline. Now, that is I would regard as being completely inappropriate and not useful to me.
No.
I think the ME community would also not see it as useful. But I think we need some updated practical guidance to help GPs and help people like me manage our condition.
Can we look globally for some of that, in the way that we ignored Asia over the fact that this virus was coming to us? We ignored continental Europe over its severity. We ignored them, and still, I think, continue to ignore them over masks. But have other coronaviruses like SARS left some survivors with similar long tail symptoms? And if so, is there anything at all we can learn from their journeys for the people suffering now?
It's a good point. And the SARS literature has shown that this chronic fatigue was a long-term effect with quite a lot of SARS people. So it's helped highlight the problem. I don't think there's enough in terms of volume to then learn from them in terms of management methods. And so I say all the time that it's very important we draw on the methods and the pacing and the literature from the chronic fatigue ME community without actually putting us, you know, we shouldn't be putting people into boxes with this new disease. I have found those techniques useful, and I think that they should be adapted and used as we move forward here.
And look, we know that the poorest around the world are among those suffering the highest rates of COVID, the highest death rates from COVID. And I presume, therefore, that long COVID has similar inequalities. You know, you talked about, I need to pace myself. Well, lucky you, right? You know, if you are a single parent, you know, on a very, very low income with, you know, small children, struggling, being totally unsupported through something like this just sounds like it would be horrendous. Have you seen any of this? Are the middle classes getting the MRIs and the CT scans to weed out whether or not it's lung scarring or you know, more of a chronic fatigue thing, while, you know, those that can't afford it just are left totally in limbo?
I agree. I acknowledge I'm in an incredibly privileged position, that my employment status and my access to resources helps me manage this. And I am so worried about other groups that are less privileged than me. This is not a middle class disease. This is happening to a lot of people. I've tried reaching out to some of the people around me, and certainly there are neighbors who've had to go back to work and then had to come have had to stop work again because they felt unwell. Their employers have not believed them. So I think it's a much bigger problem. I would anticipate it that it's a big problem, and not only in terms of suffering, but also an awareness that this is going on in wider groups in the community. The middle, you know, the people on Facebook and the people demanding for services are often going to be a privileged or middle class group. It's not always going to be the case, but I absolutely think the differentials with access, the differentials with this, and of course the problem is, as I've said, if you have this condition with long haul and you overexert yourself, then it kicks you back into bed. And I'm talking about overexerting myself because I've walked too far or I've cycled too far, not because I've had to go back to work because I'm on a 0 hours contract. This is my choice. So I think you're absolutely right in pointing that out.
Trump said last week that only 1% of COVID sufferers get it badly. And Johnson, who only left ICU a couple of months ago himself, was performing press-ups in front of the media last week to demonstrate ease of bouncing back from the disease and, you know, and the machismo of, you know, let's take it all on the chin and we can fight this thing. How do those displays make you feel?
I don't think they help anyone. It's... We have to be realistic. You sometimes see on the Facebook pages people saying, we've got to have a positive message. So how is everybody? Somebody tell us that we're better. Here I am now, at 111 days of being unwell. Yes, I'm cautiously optimistic about my progress and that I'll get better. But to pretend that this isn't happening is not helpful. And people really do need help and advice.
Anti-vaxxers, a growing and literal plague on society. Several polls that I've seen over the last few weeks showing worrying and increasing numbers of people who don't intend to get a coronavirus vaccine if one becomes available to them. What's your message to them, Paul?
It's a little bit like face masks. It's people are interpreting it as an individual choice, but actually it's in relation to the good of society and protecting others. Not necessarily people like me, but people like my dad, who's 98 now. People who, if they get the disease, will not do well on it. Mm-hmm. So it's a public health issue. But I'd also say that we are not there with the vaccine yet, and we don't know that we will have a vaccine. So to wait for a vaccine and depend on it actually being effective. So the establishing the effectiveness of these vaccines is going to be very important. Meanwhile, we need to get on with the solid public health and our own behaviours to prevent progression of this disease and its spread.
I mean, frankly, it doesn't have to be anti-vaxxers. I know plenty of, young people who have said, I'm young and fit and healthy. It won't matter if I get it. And I don't really see, vulnerable people. My parents are still in their 50s and 60s and pretty healthy. But that's just not necessarily true, is it? I mean, you're seeing people in these long COVID groups who are young, fit and healthy before contracting the disease.
Absolutely. Some of the they're often the people that are most surprised. I mean, I was surprised, and certainly young people may not get it as frequently. And certainly a number of the young doctors that I know recovered quite quickly. But some young people do develop very severe life-threatening diseases and conditions with this.
And finally, Paul, what would you really like the government to do for long COVID sufferers? I think you've been really clear about what they need to do in terms of the public health message around, masks and coronavirus more generally, but specifically for sufferers like you.
They need to, and they're probably doing this, but they need some algorithms in order to be able to screen people to know exactly what investigations people need, because a lot of people don't need a huge number of investigations. They need methods to identify people in the community, because I'm not in any government statistics at the moment. And then they need some good guidance to their general, particularly to their general practitioners and other community health teams, that allow these groups to accept these symptoms, so that people are not being having their symptoms dismissed, and that have practical ways of helping us help ourselves in terms of pacing and our recovery.
We'll draw it to a close there. Professor Garner, thank you so much for joining us today. We all hope you turn a corner in your recovery really soon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you also for listening. If you found today's show interesting, do give us a review over on Apple Podcasts. It makes a huge difference and takes less than a minute. Goodbye for now, and we'll see you very soon.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Naomi Smith. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Jacob Archbold. And audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.